This is an ABC podcast.
Once the disease is in the country, the feral pigs would become a major part of the spread of the disease, yes. In Australia, I reckon there's over 20 million of them.
With African swine fever now on our doorstep in Timor-Leste, an expert warns on the risk posed by feral pigs. And Baseball Australia hopes to start up Australia's first ever dedicated women's league next year.
I think we've got a really committed group of girls that turn up and coaches that want to coach us. We're very dedicated to the sport, and I think with a little bit more support it could certainly progress and we could get a little bit better and make our way up the ranks and hopefully raise the profile of baseball in Australia.
How regional Australia and people power will help them get a league of their own. I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. But firstly, the New South Wales government has put $16 million towards an aerial electromagnetic survey looking primarily for mineral deposits, but also sources of groundwater. 98% of the state is currently in drought, with many regional communities' water supplies at risk of running dry in the next 12 months. There are a few questions about how tenable it is to be looking for mineral deposits at such a time. Olivia Ralph has been reporting this story from Nymagee, about an hour south of Cobar, where Deputy Premier John Barilaro was watching a demonstration of the helicopter survey technology.
It'll give us the data to unlock that water sooner. And you're right, it is a balancing game in relation to agriculture, mining, every industry in relation to water. I think as a state, as a nation... we're going to have to look at water very differently in the future. But what he said for a lot of the landholders and the communities who are seeing this device flying above their properties, that we'd share that data. Some of the data is commercial in confidence, paid by private companies as well. But the stuff that the government's paying for, that information will be shared with landholders and communities. And that'll give us a better idea of where we can actually look for water.
That's New South Wales Deputy Premier John Barilaro there. And Olivia Ralph has been covering this story and she joins me on Australia Wide. Olivia, you travelled out to that demonstration of the aerial survey near Cobar in central New South Wales. What did you come across on the ground there?
Well, the survey is being conducted by a helicopter carrying what can best be described as a large metal detector-like device. Pilots are surveying the area that covers around 19,000 square kilometres. It's an area larger than the size of Greater Sydney, and the project is being overseen by the Geological Survey of New South Wales, which is a state-managed agency. The primary focus here is searching for mineral deposits, but the technology can simultaneously be used to find sources of groundwater.
And that groundwater, would that be for drinking water for local communities, or is that likely to accompany any mining projects that might be established out of this survey project?
Well, that's the main question being asked by many of the members of the surrounding communities, and it's a question I put to Mr. Barilaro. He told me that if drinkable water was located, it would ideally be allocated to surrounding properties and communities, but it is likely that undrinkable water would be found first, and that's water that's too saline for human consumption. And if that's the case, it could be utilised by existing mining operations, which might take the pressure off local dams and bores. But I also put that question to Dr. John Greenfield from the Geological Survey, who's overseeing the project, and this is what he had to say.
That's a really good point, and we can't guarantee that. We know groundwater sources are being currently used, but everything we find that's new will have to be tested. And what we're doing at the same time is we've been going through and analysing water bores throughout the region and looking at the chemistry, the saltiness of the water, and we intend to date some of the water to find out how long it's been in the ground. And basically, the older the water, the less chance it's had to recharge. And so that's the sort of water we don't want to really touch. We want to get the water that's getting recharge, and that's got the best chance of A, being fresher, but also being more viable. In this area, it's not like the Great Artesian Basin where we've got this beautiful known fresh water source. We're really scrapping around for smaller water sources in this area.
That's Dr. John Greenfield from the Geological Survey of New South Wales. And Olivia, when might the answers to some of these questions come through? Is it a drawn-out process?
It's a very complicated process. At the moment, they're conducting the survey, which is due to wrap up in November, but then comes the hard part. They have to process the results using an algorithm that's then put through supercomputers in Canberra, and then they'll start to analyse and process the findings into a final report, which is due to land sometime early next year. I spoke with Professor Adrian Werner, who specialises in hydrology and groundwater at Flinders University in South Australia, earlier today. He's quite familiar with the science behind this project, but he said that even after those results have been formulated into a report, there's a lot more work to be done on the ground.
No method is supremely conclusive. You know, there's always uncertainties in all of the methods, and the uncertainties are such that when you make an interpretation of one particular method, you're left with a lot of questions. Now, added to that is that even if they can determine whether there's groundwater there, they're not going to know whether it's easily extractable from the ground. So there can be groundwater there, but it doesn't come easily into a well because the resource that's holding it may not be really permeable. There's a lot of groundwater out there, but whether we can get it out of the ground in useful quantities is another matter. And then the other issue is how much is that groundwater being replenished? So if the groundwater is being replenished really, really slowly, and I'm talking about thousands of years, and in some cases even tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, then what you have is that groundwater becomes like a mineral in that it's not replenishable. So you could actually be mining the groundwater.
Professor Adrian Werner there. So, Olivia, that would mean that if they found groundwater, but it did in fact turn out to be a limited resource, that once used, it can't be replenished. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the biggest question that Professor Werner said would need to be considered once that report comes through next year. And this ultimately goes back to conversations we're already having about existing water sources and how to best utilise them. What are the priorities? Is it local communities? Is it economic? And in that case, that priority would be mining. Are we considering the larger ecosystems? But the underlying question is, what is the desired balance between industry, agriculture and regional communities? Is the balance right? Is it sustainable in the medium and longer term? And if not, what needs to be changed?
Is there any indication as to what the New South Wales government might end up deciding?
Well, if you go by the primary motivation for conducting the survey, it would be mining. But Mr. Barilaro has also said on numerous occasions that the government is committed to sourcing water and building water infrastructure for regional communities. And I quote, "If a few frogs have to die in the process, then so be it." So I think that gives you some sort of indication.
It'll be very interesting to see how this all plays out. Olivia, Ralph in Dubbo, thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thank you.
All around the country, you're on ABC Australia Wide.
I eat corn sometimes and my mum cooks it in the oven.
Well, Charles, how much rain did we have? He said, no, none. I said, you're mad, man.
ABC Australia Wide.
Because I came from Wynyard area where it rains and rains and rains. And when it's not raining, it's raining more.
On ABC Radio.
Yes, you are on Australia Wide with me, Alex Hyman, in for Sinead Mangan this week. An expert in African swine fever says if the disease was to reach our shores, feral pigs could be a major catalyst for spreading it around the country. Last week, it was confirmed there was an outbreak of African swine fever in Timor-Leste, which is around 650 kilometres from Australia. Dr. John Carr from James Cook University says he still believes it's unlikely the disease will reach Australia. But he explains if it did, we would need to get on top of the 20 million plus feral pigs to contain the outbreak. He spoke to Kemi Maguire.
Now, Australia has some advantages, of which one advantage it has is distance between the various farms. But our reality also is we have a vast amount of feral pigs. I mean, this disease is truly devastating. It can kill 100% of the pigs, but it can certainly kill between 20 and 80%. And sadly, my experience in Ukraine and Russia and China is certainly something like 50% of the pigs will die. And they can die very rapidly, 2 or 3 days. So this is pretty endgame.
In your opinion, how likely is the risk to feral pigs?
The virus doesn't see the difference. So from a feral pig point of view, it's like saying the difference between an Australian and a Brit. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. They're all pigs.
Would it be spread the same?
Yeah, I mean, the African swine fever, I mean, I teach my students anyway. that African swine fever is effectively a kissing disease. You've got to get very close. So it's actually very difficult to transmit it. But once it is transmitted, it's very easy to catch it, if that makes sense. So it's actually difficult to transmit it more than about 3 meters. But you only need very few particles, virus particles, for the pig to become sick. And then once it is sick, it then has to go 3 meters to another pig. The fact is in East Timor, 400 kilometers away, in itself isn't a particular risk. The risk is still probably more from potentially the Philippines or China. So we've been very vigilant over the last year to try and protect the Australian pig industry and also the feral pigs. Because as a veterinarian, I can't see the difference between them.
Is feral pigs then as high an area to protect as commercial pigs from this?
Yes. Once the disease is in the country, the feral pigs would become a major part of the spread of the disease, yes. Yeah. There's a pig for every human being. In Australia, I reckon there's over 20 million of them.
Dr. Carr, we're coming off a year where people have flocked to the Gulf to go pig hunting. We have high indigenous populations here. Are humans going to be a catalyst?
Yes, they are also at risk. No, the people are not at risk. African swine fever does nothing to human beings. I mean, absolutely nothing. But the hunters and the indigenous people, if they are hunting the wild pigs, they have to be careful that they don't transmit the virus around as well. What I would like to ask hunters and in general is if they find some dead pigs, they must contact the authorities. And then the authorities will investigate why they're dead. People's curiosity would be such that people would go over and probably touch it. I mean, African swine fever is actually quite easy to kill. You just need to wash your hands in soap and water. So people themselves are a potential risk. But the reality of, I mean, if I post-mortem a pig with African swine fever, and then I have a shower, then I'm basically fine. I mean, but if I post-mortem a pig with African swine fever, go onto a pig farm and let the pig lick my hand, then there's a high chance that I'd transmit the virus. But if I wash my hands, wash my clothes, then the risk becomes relatively small. The big risk is a pig will eat another pig or kiss another pig. So the problem we have with the hunters, particularly in the north, was if African swine fever came and some feral pigs then died, we need to know that as soon as possible.
Redness that comes with African swine fever, I know we're saying the disease can't tell the difference, but can we spot symptoms between feral pigs or commercial?
Yes, I mean, with a feral pig, it's probably unlikely that you would notice that. I mean, from a commercial point of view, the classic clinical signs would be a very, very hot red pig with very hot, very red ears. Their body temperatures go to 42, 43, 44 degrees. A pig is normally around 38 to 40. So you've got a raging high temperature. And that's one of the reasons why the poor things die. But a white pig would appear to be very red and have very red ears. But I would argue in the feral pigs that those clinical signs are probably not going to be seen. This will be a developing problem. Sadly, it's not going to go away in any time soon.
That's Dr. John Carr, veterinarian and senior lecturer at James Cook University, speaking with Kemi Maguire about the outbreak of African swine fever in Timor-Leste, which could be very problematic if it reaches Australian shores. Here's hoping that it doesn't.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
It's a species that I have been fighting for.
Growing up in the bush is such a special thing.
So when the rain does come, we've got a few numbers.
What
got
if it never comes?
Put a feather in your cap.
ABC Radio.
Alex Hyman with you here on Australia Wide. The Australian women's baseball team had a great opportunity last week to play against the world number one Japan's All-Stars at an event called the Bendigo Challenge. And the future of baseball in central Victoria is looking greater than ever, with the possibility of the country's first dedicated women's league. Beth Gibson went down to Strathfield Say Reserve to find out more about the women dedicated to the sport.
As you guys probably have seen with the cricket and the footy, and there's a big movement behind women's sport at the moment, and definitely baseball is one of those where the girls go out and play just as hard as the guys do, and it's something that funding would make a huge difference for us just in terms of opportunities and potential of where our sport can actually go.
The Australian national women's baseball team, the Emeralds, are currently ranked number 6 in the world.
That's pretty good for a team that doesn't get any federal government funding. And despite the fact that baseball doesn't get much attention in Australia, there are many women dedicated to the sport. Shay Lily White is an infielder with the Emeralds, and her love of the game stems back to childhood.
I started playing when I was 10 with my brother, just a local club, and then, yeah, progressed through the junior baseball with the boys and then started the women's when I was 13, and we were lucky enough to play in the first World Series when I was 16.
Morgan Doherty is a centre fielder and a pitcher with the Emeralds, and she says it's hard to describe why she loves baseball so much.
Everything. I don't know, I love it. There's so much, like, involved in behind it, like all the strategy and just, and I think the thing for me, like, I've been playing for nearly 20 years, I guess, and I'm still learning, like, that you don't stop. And
the game, just, it's a very hard game. I think there's only sort of selected few that can really handle it. It's a tough game, so you see who sort of can handle that as you progress through. So I like that it's quite hard.
What's tough about it, do you think?
The elements, so many elements, pitching, catching, defence, hitting, mental side, physical side. It's hard to come out every day and play, so, yeah, you have to be pretty tough to keep doing it.
Morgan says there are currently limited opportunities for semi-professional and professional women's baseball in Australia.
Well, we've got our national tournament every year over Easter, so all the girls sort of train and play for their states, and then once a year we have that opportunity to play each other and get together, and then every 2 years we've got our World Cup. Once you get to play at that level once, even if it's just a week-long tournament, that's all you want. Like, I go home and I'm like, damn, it's 2 years until I get to play at that level again. It's just, you really get that that bug to just play at the highest level you can. It's unreal.
Michael Crooks is a general manager of operations and participation at Baseball Australia, and he says one of the reasons opportunities are limited for the professional women's game is because it's not an Olympic sport.
The women's game internationally has really only emerged as well over the last 15 to 20 years. It's only been a World Cup for the last 10 years in place.
Shay says the low profile of baseball in Australia also doesn't help.
There's just not as much knowledge about the game. We don't get to see it on TV. We don't get to sort of do any publicity. I think it's just a lack of awareness, mostly.
Baseball Australia is hoping to boost the game by launching a dedicated women's league in the next few years. Michael says they've been inspired by the success of new women's leagues in the AFL and the NRL.
Look, I think what it shows is that women's professional leagues are viable entities in their own right. And it goes beyond those two sports. If we look at the history of the National Basketball League, the Women's National Basketball League, that has stood the test of time over quite a long period of time. It's had its challenges over the years. And it's we need to get away from the perception that the women's leagues are separate in construct to men's leagues. They're as entertaining to watch as any men's competition is, and we believe that it's the right thing for anyone that's a fan of sport to come out and support sport in all ways, shapes and forms, regardless of what the competition is, regardless of what the gender is or what the abilities are.
Michael says the league will be funded in a variety of ways. The current men's baseball teams will bid for licences and provide some funding, as well as some of the state governments. They've also launched a fundraiser hoping to raise $250,000 from the public.
What we don't want to do is create something which is in place for a year or two and falls by the wayside because it hasn't been thought through in a lot of detail in terms of how it's funded and how we make sure that every component of it is able to stand on its own two feet.
For players, having a regular opportunity to play the game at a high level will be life-changing.
It's probably been a dream since I was a little girl, yeah. Just to be able to play professional baseball and in Australia would be a dream come true, yeah.
I mean, it's just a great chance to showcase the hard work that everyone puts in, the dedication, and yeah, I think it'd be nice just for people to see that girls actually play. So, and great for us to get more high-level competition.
Shay hopes the new league will boost the popularity of the game and attract more funding.
I think we've got a really committed group of girls that turn up and coaches that want to coach us. We're very dedicated to the sport, and I think with a little bit more support it could certainly progress and we could get a little bit better and make our way up the ranks and hopefully raise the profile of baseball in Australia. So.
Beth Gibson with that report on the possibility of Australia's first women's baseball league.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
I don't want to put a killjoy on their fabulous family tradition, but
that was just mayhem and chaos.
The majority of them are still buying their trees, regardless of the snake.
So this is the first time we've opened the slide this summer.
On ABC Radio.
And now to Karajini National Park in the Hamersley Range of Western Australia, where a school holiday snakebite emergency brought a show of community spirit. Rebecca Parrish has this report.
Yeah, when they bite you, it's an instant sting. It wasn't too bad, but it was definitely, wow, oh, that's a real sting.
It can be said that community spirit in regional Australia is pretty strong. If people need a hand, there's always many, many offers of help. And that community spirit was on display on Friday when Perth man Bruce Christie was bitten by a snake just after midnight while camping in Karajini National Park with his kids.
It was a bit windy, the tent was flapping a bit, I needed to pee, so I got up, took a couple of steps, bang, yeah, that really hurts, what the hell just happened, got the torch, looked around, couldn't see any sign of whatever it was that had bitten me, looked down at my ankle, there was blood coming from a puncture wound, there was another puncture wound very close to it, you know, like about an inch, less than an inch, apart, and it was stinging like all hell, it was starting to swell up.
Bruce was camping at the Karajini Eco Retreat when he was bitten. In a classic dad move, though, he went against everything he'd taught his kids to do just that day in this type of situation.
Just that afternoon, I've been lecturing the kids on what to do, you know, when you're bitten by a snake, which is clearly don't move, compression bandage, ring 000. So dad does the opposite. I got in the car and tried to find the manager at the Eco Resort, which was the wrong move. Went back to the tent and told the kids what was going to happen and sat down, wrapped my foot in a bandage and called 000.
Tom Price St John's volunteers made the 80-kilometre trip to help Bruce, who was flown by RFDS the next day to Port Hedland Hospital, a four-hour drive away. But not only did volley Lauren McDonald attend to Bruce's injuries, she even offered beds for his kids to make sure that they were well looked after.
Yeah, I actually tended to him out at the Eco Retreat, myself and another volunteer, Zane, took the call and responded to him. The 14-year-old was suggesting she'd stay there and look after the sibling. And as a mother, I went, no, nah, not a chance. I said, come in, you can stay at my house, we'll look after you. If it's a few days, no big deal. I've got a couple of kids at home, so school holidays, they thought it was wonderful to have them here. So we brought them in and they stayed with us for the night until Bruce actually came back the following day.
The community spirit didn't stop there, though. After being flown to Hedland, Bruce had to get back to Tom Price. And less than an hour after posting on social media asking for help, Bruce had confirmed a passenger seat in the car of someone making the drive that afternoon. And while he says it was a huge showing of community support, Lauren says it's just another day in regional WA.
We all kind of come up here for work and we don't have family, we don't know people, so we rely on each other up here. And so that's what you do. It wasn't even a second thought for me. It was just, it had to be done. Someone had to take them.
Now though, after spending the weekend back out at Karajini, Bruce and his kids will continue on their journey around the north.
We're heading over to Coral Bay soon, so I'm just going to try avoid being bitten by a shark or having a croc encounter. people have been so generous and so helpful. It's really overwhelming. I feel very lucky. If you're going to get bitten anywhere in the world by a snake, make sure it's around Karajini, Tom Price. That's all I can say.
That story from Rebecca Parrish in WA's Northwest, where the community has come together to help with a snake bite emergency, and by the sounds of things, a great outcome there. So well done to all involved. And that's the program for this Monday evening. Remember, you can always listen back to Australia Wide by visiting our website or searching for the Australia-wide program on your favourite podcast service, and make sure you subscribe. You can also head to our website and send us an email if you'd like to get in touch with the program. We'd love to hear from you. And remember, you can always visit the ABC News website for all news and information on the stories you've heard tonight and a whole lot more as well. I'm Alex Hyman. Thanks so much for your company this evening. I'll be back again tomorrow filling in for Sinead Mangan. Have a great night.
This is an ABC podcast.